This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The big ugly bill passed the Senate. Now it goes to the House. We'll talk to Chip Roy about that. How much of a win was that Supreme Court decision last week? We will find out. The most frightening segment you've ever seen on this show. Plus, something to feel great about on I'm Right. Let's talk about something wonderful. And I am aware that the big story of the day is the big, beautiful bill. We're going to get to that with Congressman Chip Roy in about 10 minutes. What passed the Senate? Will it pass the House? What's in it? What's good? What's bad? We are going to get to all that. I don't want to talk about that right now because I'm very, very proud of you. I'm proud of me. I'm proud of us. You know, when you hand out criticism to people, that's fine, but you better be willing to hand out compliments. If you're going to whip, you better hand out sugar cubes. For the longest time, I have been very, very hard on the GOP primary voter. Because you look in Washington, D.C., and you see loser after loser after loser in the Senate and the House. And I'm not talking about Democrats. I'm talking about Republicans. Yes, Democrats are vicious, demonic communists trying to burn down America. But it is Republicans, a group of Republicans, mostly from red states, that hold the door open for them and let them do this. And this is because the GOP primary voter has been lazy, stupid, and worthless. The GOP primary voter has traditionally not shown up to even vote in a primary. And when he does show up, he votes for the incumbent almost every time and then goes home and whines about the GOP. It's driven me crazy. How many times have you heard me yell about it? But we are getting better. We are getting smarter. We are getting more involved, and changing a party, a political party in the United States of America, it is not an overnight process. It's not an event. It's a process. We've had that talk before. It's going to take time. It takes years to change a political party, years to clean out the gunk, to get rid of this guy in the House and this guy in the Senate. You try to challenge them in a primary, but your candidate fails. You don't raise the money. You have too many. The voter doesn't show. There's a laundry list of reasons, but it takes time to change a party from something bad into something that reflects you and something that reflects me. But we are doing it. I can just in recent memory, I can think of several losers in the GOP like Jeff Flake who are gone. Now there are more. Don Bacon of Nebraska, he's a member of the House, useless idiot, retiring. Mitch McConnell, retiring. Last time I saw Mitch McConnell at a public event in Kentucky, remember this is a state where he's ruled like a god king forever, he was booed off the stage. Tom Tillis, North Carolina, retiring. You know, this Tom Tillis?
I have no tolerance for anybody who entered the building on January the 6th, and that's probably where most of the friction was. If Mr. Martin were being put forth as a U.S. attorney for any district except the district where January 6th happened, the protest happened, I'd probably support him.
The most favored nation coming out of the administration, all these other things are short-sighted, unsustainable measures.
It's time for regime change, and I believe that this president should be given a fair amount of leeway to affect that.
So, look, I'm a Republican. I support President Trump, and I believe that most of his policies on national security are right. I believe his instincts are pretty good. But what I'm telling you, whoever believes that there is any space for Vladimir Putin in the future of a stable globe, better go to Ukraine. They better go to Europe. They better invest the time to understand that this man is a cancer and the greatest threat to democracy in my lifetime.
Yeah, he's retiring. He's retiring because of you. He's retiring because he can't win re-election. And so, of course, he had to make up a lie. They all say the same lie. They're retiring to be with family. He's not retiring to be with family. Being a senator is his entire life. It's all he cares about. He's retiring to avoid humiliation. Whether he'll spend time with family or not, I don't know. He's retiring because you, the GOP primary voter, have let him know he's no longer welcome. We have got win after win after win in recent years of losers like Mitt Romney retiring because of you.
You know, contrary to a lot of expectations, I enjoy my work in the Senate a good deal. The last few years have been particularly productive, as I was able to help lead and negotiate the bipartisan infrastructure law, a comprehensive China strategy process, religious liberty protections, a compromised gun safety law, the Electoral Count Act reform, and emergency COVID relief funding. Now, we face critical challenges, mounting national debt, climate change, and the ambitious authoritarians of Russia and China. Neither President Biden nor former President Trump are leading their party to confront those issues. While I'm not running for re-election, I'm not retiring from the fight. I'll be your United States Senator until January of 2025.
And he's gone. Tom Tillis gone. Don Bacon gone. Mitch McConnell gone. Guess who else is about to be gone? John Cornyn.
Hi, I'm Texas Senator John Cornyn. The last year has proven quite a challenge as we've navigated the impact of COVID-19. But with safe and effective vaccines finally being administered, there's light at the end of the tunnel. Getting vaccinated is the fastest way that life can return to normal.
Under the effective leadership of Director Ray, the agency has remained committed to doing things independently and by the book.
Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. I've called this the most important law that most people have never heard of. It's been called the crown jewel of U.S. intelligence.
About to be gone. What's the deal with all this? You, me, the GOP primary voter, is no longer sitting at home just complaining and then going down and voting for the incumbent. The GOP primary voter has gotten up off the couch and has decided to change his voting habits, and as such, the GOP is changing into something better, and you deserve the credit for it. Put a smile on your face. I'm proud of us. We're doing good. I don't think any of that made you uncomfortable. Maybe it did. Even still, I'm right. I'm very comfortable. But it's probably because I have a belly full of massa chips. I'm not going to lie. I ate half a bag right before the show started. I can't help it. And look, now my wife, she can't even yell at me about the chips. Because massa chips have three ingredients. No more seed oil stuff. No more. You want chips that you don't have to feel guilty about? Massa chips. And this is me. When I heard they were healthy, I thought to myself, oh, it's going to be garbage. I did. That's what I normally think about healthy things. Every time Ob tries to give me something healthy, it's disgusting. Massa chips are amazing. Amazing. Dab a little hot sauce on there. My youngest son, he eats worse than I do. Loves them. We fight over them. He takes bags and hides them in his bedroom. Get some Massa chips and save a pile of money. You can scan that little thing right there. Or go to massachips.com/JesseTV. You want to binge chips without feeling guilty? There you go. We'll be back. Okay, so I didn't talk much about the big, beautiful bill in the open because I wanted to talk about something wonderful, and I did. But it is important that we discuss what exactly passed, what's going to pass, and remember that there's no such thing as a big bill that is beautiful from a United States government this corrupt. It's not humanly possible. It'd be like asking how much makeup you have to put on Joy Behar to make her attractive. It's not humanly possible to do it. But let's find out what it is. Do we have a bill? Anyway, Chip Roy, great congressman from the state of Texas, joins us now. Okay, Chip, it passed the House. Then it went to the Senate, and it passed the Senate, and now it's coming back. It's got to pass the House before I get the... What do we have? What's the process like? I don't understand.
I don't know, but You need to start a new meter that shows how much makeup you need to put on Joy Behar's face in order for something to be beautiful. That was fantastic. I'm now fully distracted, completely incapable of putting out anything intelligent here. So,
all right, Chip.
So look, here's the thing. Every one of us, you, me, I mean, all the conservatives I know, people that I work with here, we want to be with the president to deliver a bill that will, you know, make tax cuts permanent, make sure that more money's in all our pockets, help all the working class Americans, get the border funding needed for ICE to undo all the damage of Biden, all of those things that we know are important. But remember, I set out 6 months ago, I got the Freedom Caucus to lead into it and say, guys, we should do two separate bills. The first bill should just take care of what the president wants to do on the debt ceiling, take care of what the president wants to do on the border and defense, and move forward quickly so we can get something done. Well, they wanted to do a big, beautiful bill. Well, here we are. And I agree with you. Nothing big is ever going to be beautiful in this town. And so what we've got is a bill that has some good things in it that we fought for in the House. A couple of things in the Senate that were actually not bad. Rick Scott, Mike Lee, Rand Paul, and Ron Johnson have been out there fighting the good fight. But mostly what we have is a traditional massive bill that will have significant amount of deficit spending. No matter what the administration says, no matter what my colleagues in the House and the Senate say, we've got objective friends who are economists, budget people, who worked for Trump, who are with us. We want to deliver, but the math's just not there. The deficits in the first 5 years are huge. It has significant problems in the bill. And what they just passed, I mean, I can't even say this out loud without getting fuming mad. They basically gave a big giveaway to the moderates that gutted most of our work to repeal and terminate the Green New Scam. I mean, you can't even make it up. The president said terminate it. We terminated like 60% of it in the House. I think they just gutted it. And now we terminate maybe 30 or 40% of it at max. And by the way, we're going to continue to provide Medicaid to illegal aliens. We're going to continue to have taxpayer funding go to transgender surgeries, including kids. We only restrict Planned Parenthood funding for the first year, not for 10 years. And there are problem after problem. They created a new $50 billion rural hospital fund. They created a new radiation exposure fund that they say will only be $6 billion, but everybody I talk to will be $200 billion. Look, I don't know how to put it. The swamp is going to swamp. And if the administration isn't willing to lean on everybody and say, end this crazy, then why am I on the hook to vote for a bill just so I can get some tax cuts and border, which is what I want, but I don't want all the spending. Here we are.
Okay. Where is it now, Chip? We're well aware of your feelings on it. I know it's coming back to the House. Is it going to pass the House? From my understanding, there's a vote tomorrow. Please feel free to correct me on that. But is what it is now, is it good enough to pass the House? Did they make it so crappy that even it can't pass the House? Where is it now?
So we're going to be in the Rules Committee. In fact, we're in the Rules Committee right now. When I finish this interview, I'm going to walk back upstairs to the third floor of the Capitol, where I'm sitting in the Rules Committee listening to all the testimony. We'll vote on it in the Rules Committee sometime by probably midnight. And I think it'll be on the floor tomorrow. I think there's a significant number of House Republicans who do not believe that they can vote for this bill. I currently am one of those. I'm reading the bill. I'm looking at the bill while we're sitting there. I'm listening to see what the changes are. I'm always open to make sure there's something I'm missing that I don't understand. But I look at the bill and I say, does it increase deficits? Will we issue more bonds and more debt as a result of this bill? I think we will. Does this bill continue to do things we shouldn't do, like give Medicaid to illegal aliens? I think it does. Does this bill terminate the Green New Scam? No, it waters it down what we did, which I thought was sort of a bare minimum. So there are things in it that I just don't think pass muster. I'm not alone. There are dozens of members of the House that have talked to me about how frustrated they are, and they're considering voting no. I don't know how many that will be in the end.
Okay. Let me attempt to put a smiling face on something here. What's good in it?
Well, so look, I mean, everything we've been working on for 6 months to try to get some Green New Scam subsidies reversed. Yeah, the bill still has some of that, although it's so watered down, I'm not sure. We did get serious Medicaid reforms. We got work requirements. We got some work requirements for food stamps. It would enrage you how much we had to water some of that down in the Senate, by the way. Some of those things are, in fact, net improvements. They'll tell you that we got like $1.5 trillion of savings. But Jesse, to be clear, That's reductions in increases. And our deficits are still going to continue to be roughly $2 trillion a year for a decade. So, look, there are good things. We've worked really hard to try to get them. The president's team has worked hard with us. Look, they're my friends, and I hate being at odds with them. I love the president and what he's doing. I want to deliver. But here we sit, and I didn't come to Washington to increase deficits. I didn't come to Washington to continue the Green New Scam. Why can't we just repeal it? That's what Democrats do. They get in office, and they do all the stuff. They passed the Green New Scam on reconciliation. They passed Obamacare on reconciliation. Republicans can't even reverse the bad things Democrats do, much less do something really, wow, you totally changed the game, guys. So the president is kicking ass. Congress is up here dithering, and I'm trying to do my best. You know, Rumsfeld said, you go to war with the army you got. Congress is what it is. I've compromised. I gave. I voted for the House bill to go to the Senate. I voted for the budget. I voted, all these things trying to move the ball down the field. But here we are. And I think it fails. And I think we need to go back to the well. Look, the bill doesn't die if we kill it this week. We can go back to the well and go try to fix it. Go to the Senate. We should amend it. Send it back to the Senate with a House bill or something like it. Say, guys, try again. That's what we should do.
Chip, can you help me understand something? And I'm not asking you to name names. It's my job to be a jerk to everybody and make everyone in Washington mad. It's not yours. So a United States senator, I understand the reluctance of some of these losers to repeal all the Green New Scam stuff because their state gets a lot of that cheddar and that's how they think they get reelected. Okay, I get that. I disagree, but I get that. But can you help me understand why red state senators would insist on Medicaid for illegals? There's not a red state senator in the United States of America that gets elected by handing out Medicaid to illegals. It's such a Democrat priority. Can you help me understand what the motivation would be there?
What they do is they listen to hospitals in their state or in their district. In this case, senators, it's their state. And those hospitals will come back and say, guys, we've got all these illegals in our hospital rooms and in our emergency rooms. And no matter what the crackdown is, we still have hundreds of thousands of them. And we need that federal funding in order to deal with the fact that we're required to have care in the emergency rooms. And you know what? To some degree, they're not wrong. But my view is you have to cut off the funding supply. You have to stop it from the top. And then the hospitals will then have to come back and say, guys, we can't do this. And then that forces more pressure to change the policies and remove more illegal aliens. But that's what happens. And they and these Republican senators listen. They go, okay, I guess we got to do that.
God, so freaking frustrated. Chip, thank you so much for coming by and updating us as always. Thanks for fighting the good fight, my brother. Good luck. I was in a good mood. Remember, I started off the show, I was in a good mood, and I'm in a bad mood. I don't like that. It's frustrating. It's very, very frustrating. The GOP is very, very frustrating. But this is why, look, just like we just talked about in the opening of the show, this is why we have to stay engaged. We have done a lot of cleanup, but we have a lot more cleanup to do. There are a lot of turds still on the floor. They're red state senators, and they're turds, and they smell. And we've got to clean them up and disinfect things, all right? We'll have the energy to do that because we're all going to be on male vitality stacks or female vitality stacks from Chalk. Surely you're already on one, right? Don't worry. We're talking natural things, natural herbal supplements. As I've watched the medical profession violate all my trust over the last few years and yours, I started to really seek out natural solutions for things. So when it comes to things like your energy level, your focus, we just kind of accept that those things go down as we get older, but we don't have to accept that at all. We're just not getting the things we want, the things we need, I should say. That's where Chalk comes in. You want to be able to skip that afternoon coffee, that afternoon nap? Chalk's here for you. Natural herbal supplements. Here's what you need to do. Go to chalk.com/JesseTV. Subscription. Get a subscription. After 90 days, if you don't feel better, cancel it. I want you to. They won't make it hard. 90 days, you're about to feel like a new person. We'll be back.
We'll be right back.
All right. Last week we had a wonderful Supreme Court decision, but idiots like me are confused. Was it a decision that stopped these ridiculous nationwide injunctions by these judges? That did it end birthright citizenship? I've seen headline after headline, and they're all saying different things, and I don't know what's going on. So obviously we need to bring in the great professor, Bill Jacobson, Cornell University law professor, and of course, founder of Legal Insurrection. Okay, Bill, what was this? Are we done with birthright citizenship?
No, we're not even close to done. We are done with a narrow set of relief that the district courts have been imposing on the country called universal injunctions, where a single federal district judge binds the entire country and everybody in it to a ruling, even though those people are not part of the court case. That's what's plagued Trump 1.0 administration and Trump 2.0 administration, because there are over 650 federal judges, and Trump needs to win every single time, because any one of those judges could terminate a program of his or an action of his, whereas the challengers only need to win once. They only need to win one case. So the Supreme Court said that the federal district courts do not have the authority, except in rare circumstances, to issue these universal injunctions. But as you can guess, there's a big but about that.
Yeah, that's, you know what, you got me right away, Bill, when I heard you say narrow. Why don't you go ahead and just explain what that means?
Sure. So what the court said is that as a general matter, the federal district courts, which are created by Congress, most people don't realize this, the federal district courts are created by Congress, not the Constitution. The Constitution only creates the Supreme Court, and therefore the federal district courts can only do what Congress has given them jurisdiction to do. Notwithstanding federal judges thinking they are all powerful, in fact, they are hemmed in by federal legislation. And that federal legislation, the Supreme Court held, does not permit federal district court judges to issue these broad injunctions, except they can fashion those if it's absolutely necessary to afford somebody what they called complete relief, meaning if there's no other alternative to it, or they could use other procedural mechanisms, which is what I expect to see and we're already seeing, which is class actions. So class action lawsuits are lawsuits brought on behalf of a group of people by a representative plaintiff, and they can bind hundreds of thousands or millions of plaintiffs who have a very common issue, and they can bind the entire class of people. So there is a big loophole. This is a big deal, the fact that the judges now have to think of alternative ways of going there, but nobody should think that this ends it. And in fact, the case that was before the Supreme Court about the birthright citizenship executive order has already been refiled as a class action. So big win for Trump, will affect a lot of cases against him, but it's not a perfect remedy. It doesn't shut the door completely. It shuts it most of the way.
Okay, so it's not a silver bullet that got us all the way through, but I mean, does this mean we're going to see a fraction as many of these as we saw before? Half as many? Handicap it for us.
Yeah, I think it's going to be half as many. I think that most of the judges will have to go through this analysis that the Supreme Court has given. So it will stop a lot of the abusive injunctions, but it's not going to stop all of them. And it will simply make the plaintiffs and the more activist federal judges more conniving in how they frame things. But it also should embolden appeals courts that will maybe put an end to it. So the best I can say is it's a very positive development. Trump administration was right to celebrate it, but nobody should think that the lawfare project that the Democrats have embarked on to stymie the administration through dozens and hundreds of lawsuits, that's going to stop anytime soon.
All right. All right. Now let's talk about the ruling itself, because somebody who surprised everybody was Amy Coney Barrett, not necessarily for how she voted. She can be here or there with that, but for how she just, in the most professional way possible, just whipped Ketanji Brown Jackson. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard it described many different ways, and I've described it different ways. But, she took KBJ out to the woodshed and beat her legally pretty soundly. I mean, they didn't call her stupid. They didn't call her incompetent. They didn't call her, ignorant, but they came pretty close. They called her those things without using those words. They basically said, we're going to ignore everything she's saying in her dissenting opinion because it's contrary to 200 years of constitutional law and contrary to the Constitution itself. And what Ketanji Brown Jackson said was, notwithstanding the legalese of the statutes, she used the term legalese, and the majority mocked her for that. Notwithstanding the legalese, which of course is exactly what judges are supposed to pay attention to, notwithstanding the legalese, we should do what we think is right. And it's a very activist, very critical legal theory, very social justice warrior approach to things, which is if a judge sees a problem she doesn't like, the judge should solve the problem and should not get bogged down in all these things like limited jurisdiction. And in fact, one of the most famous lines, there were many of them from the majority decision, was that Ketanji Brown Jackson decries the imperial executive, but in fact wants an imperial judiciary. She wants a judiciary which can do whatever they want. And that's just not the way it's set up. That's not the constitutional structure. It's not the legislative structure. It's not the way things have been treated for 200 years. And this is really what you see when you get a total social justice warrior on the court. You get dispensing with our constitutional traditions and our constitutional protections, and somebody who does whatever they want. And so it was a really brutal, there were just some great lines in there to quote and mock Ketanji Brown Jackson. I keep wanting to say Jackson Brown because I grew up listening to Jackson Brown. Ketanji Brown Jackson, it was an embarrassment. But what's important is one, it was an Amy Coney Barrett decision. She's not known as a hothead on the bench, okay? If this thing was written by Alito, you could certainly understand it. But this was by somebody who's viewed as very polite and very proper on the court. She wrote it, and six judges joined in it. Remember, any of those judges could have said, hey, I don't think this is appropriate for the majority decision. You want to bash her, go do it in a concurring opinion, in your own separate opinion. They all signed on to it. The six justices signed on to this bashing of Ketanji Brown Jackson. And importantly, her dissent was not joined by any other justice. Not even Sotomayor nor Kagan were willing to put their name on what Brown Jackson had written. That's how bad it was. And so she's a laughing stock, frankly, after this majority decision. And it doesn't matter to her, I'm sure, because she's got life tenure. She'll be there forever. We've got her for 20 or 30 more years, but she's not well regarded, and the majority just let the world know it.
Bill, as an aside, before I ask you about denaturalization, as a law professor, do you find that the students in your law school are radicalized when they get there or radicalized before they get there?
Well, I teach a course that has nothing to do with politics or social justice or anything like that. My students, I think, are pretty straight down the middle. And I think I'm fortunate I'm at a law school that is not Columbia Law School, it's not Harvard Law School, it's not as radicalized. So I don't think the students, at least my students, become radicalized in law school. But there are certainly your social justice warriors who arrive that way. So I would say to the ex it's more a problem of how they are when they arrive and their world outlook that they've been taught in high school, maybe even K through 12 and college. They have a certain world outlook that I don't necessarily agree with. And that's, I think, more of a problem as opposed to what takes place in the law school, turning them into some sort of radicals. So that's my personal observation, but I think in general, law schools do push students towards becoming more left-leaning.
All right, let's talk about something near and dear to my heart, and from what I understand, near and dear to yours, denaturalization. This is not something that's been tossed around a lot. The GOP's been real shy about things like that and wanting to kind of play nice, but the DOJ indicates they're going to start looking at it. Explain what it is, why, where are we going from here?
Sure. Well, if you have been naturalized as a citizen, so you're not, you know, born here, and you go through the immigration process and the naturalization process, if at any point along that line you make material misrepresentations, you forget to disclose, not forget, you don't disclose things, you intentionally don't disclose things, or you lie on your applications, the government can move to rescind your naturalization, to strip you of your citizenship. And I covered at my website about a decade ago a very famous case involving a Palestinian terrorist named Razmiya Odeh. And she came to the United States. She lied on her visa application about her terrorist connections. She lied on her naturalization application about it. She denied having any connections, but she did. And many years later, I think it was 15 years later, the FBI picked up on it. And they filed criminal charges against her to strip her of her citizenship. And that is what eventually happened. She lost the first trial. She got a retrial. And right before the second trial, she consented to leave the country and she was stripped of her citizenship. So if there is a person here who lied on their immigration papers and their naturalization papers, for example, maybe they misrepresented their family connections, maybe they committed marriage fraud to become a citizen. And I don't, you know, I'm not talking about anybody in particular, but there have been allegations against a congresswoman about that. If it is substantiated, if somebody lied to get into the United States and get citizenship, the government absolutely has a mechanism to strip them of that. And the Department of Justice, again, I don't know if they have a particular person in mind, but the Department of Justice has said they're going to start looking into that for people who have obtained citizenship and to challenge it. So it absolutely is a procedure. It has been used in the past, and it can be used in the present.
I just want to make sure I'm being crystal clear with everybody that the professor was not discussing Ilhan Omar, who lied and married her brother to get into the country. He never mentioned that name at all. I just want to make sure he never mentioned Ilhan Omar. Thank you so much, Professor. I appreciate you. All right. Apparently it's Professor Day. You know how highly educated I am. But we're going to talk to a next one. Professor G joins us next. And this, trying to think, we've been doing I'm Right for a long time. This has the potential to be the most frightening segment you've ever watched on the show. Just wait, hang on.
Domestic terrorism from white supremacists is the most lethal terrorist threat in the homeland.
White supremacists, right-wing extremists, and domestic terrorists trying to stoke fear in the hearts of New Yorkers.
From a terrorism perspective, I think domestic violent extremism is one of the greatest terrorism-related threats that we face.
In the FBI's view, the top domestic violent extremist threat comes from racially or ethnically motivated violent extremists, specifically those who advocated for the superiority of the white race.
Remember how many conversations we had about what they were doing there? Remember, we've talked about this many times before. You've never met a white supremacist in your life. I haven't either. But they were doing that to preemptively justify sending the forces of government after their political opponents. And as I've told you many times before, I don't care what else is going on in any part of the world. There is nothing in the world more dangerous to you and to me than our government turning its guns against us. Joining me now, Nicholas Giordano, community college professor and higher education fellow at Campus Reform, has an incredible piece up on the Federalist about this very thing. Professor, what did they do?
Well, the Biden administration issued what was called the National Strategy for Countering Domestic Terrorism. And this is one of the more terrifying government documents that exists, because what it does is it turns ordinary citizens into potential targets as domestic violent extremists. It says that anyone expressing anti-government sentiment or anti-authority sentiment has the proclivity towards domestic terrorism, yet they never define what anti-government or anti-authority actually means. What they use is examples. And so if you push back against any of the pandemic responses, the pandemic mandates, well, then you have a potential to be a domestic terrorist. So this document was issued in June of 2021. And what do we know? Well, we know that just a few months later, after it was issued, the government began targeting parents at school board meetings who were complaining about their children wearing masks in school or what they were learning about in the curricula, that it was more based on indoctrination as opposed to education. They targeted traditional Catholics. We now know that the FBI's traditional Catholic memo was more widespread than Director Wray led on, and that it was actually actionable when operational, where they tried to infiltrate churches because Catholics believe in pro-life, they believe in two genders, and so it goes against the narrative that the Biden administration wanted to put out. But it wasn't just limited to the FBI and Department of Homeland Security. If we look at the Department of Education, Campus Reform issued a report where 70% of the university fines towards higher education went to Catholic and Christian institutions. In fact, the last Secretary of Education actually stated out loud that he would like to put Christian universities out of business, particularly Grand Canyon University. So we see it wasn't to stop domestic terrorism. It wasn't to make Americans safer. What it was designed to target ordinary Americans that dissented from the government narrative. And that's the threat that this document posed.
Professor, I'm going to ask a question, and it's probably going to be a lame question, but in my mind, it's the most important thing in the world. Aren't there safeguards in place in our system to stop, you know, some dirty communist from taking over the White House and just sending the FBI after school board moms? It surely can't be as easy as getting on Microsoft Word and typing up a memo and shipping it off to Christopher Wray. That can't be how it works, right?
Well, that's not the way it's supposed to work, but that's how the system has morphed throughout the years. As the bureaucracy has grown, it has strengthened, it's become more powerful. And I argue that it's almost emerged as a fourth branch of government that's unencumbered by the Constitution. It doesn't follow the checks and balances, that it's independent from the legislative branch and the executive branch. In fact, some would argue that it has more power than the president, who's supposed to be the one that actually runs the bureaucracy. But the bureaucracy has long done what it wants, and there's no accountability within the system. For example, just on several occasions in the Biden administration, the FBI illegally accessed the NSA's repository on Americans. And the courts lambasted the FBI for doing this, yet nobody was ever held accountable. The CIA was caught spying on sitting members of the United States Senate, and nobody was held accountable. When we look at the prison program that was run through the NSA, where they were collecting the metadata of every single American, not a single person was held accountable. So since the bureaucracy is never held accountable, it deems that it could do what it wants. And they've kind of labeled themselves as the guardians of what they call democracy, where they get to determine what the threats are, and they get to use it against ordinary Americans.
That is honestly some of the most frightening stuff I've ever heard in my entire life, because the implications of it are East Germany stuff. If the FBI just can do whatever, the CIA can do whatever, and there is nobody who will or can hold them accountable, then why even have elections?
Well, let's look at it this way, right? So if we read through the national strategy, I encourage your audience to read it. It's only 31 pages. It says anti-government or anti-authority sentiment. It doesn't say anti-American sentiment. So what the document is really about is it's about protecting the bureaucracy itself and empowering the bureaucracy. So you could criticize and threaten America all day long. That's fine. But when you start to question government, well, that's anti-government sentiment. When you question government policies, that's anti-authority sentiment. And if you look at Pillar 4 of the national strategy, it says, well, if you adopt a far left agenda, you know, DEI in schools, radical gun control, well, that's the only way to combat this idea of domestic terrorism. That's the only way to take on the threat. And that's why President Trump should immediately rescind this document. Congress should actually defund any type of agency or any type of operation where tax dollars are going to this document, because our tax dollars should not be used to silence us. Our tax dollars should not be used to allow the government to target us. And it's gone on for way too long. And if nobody steps in and stops this document now, well, there's nothing that prevents this administration or the next administration or any subsequent administration from taking it even a step further than the Biden administration did.
Golly, that is sobering. Speaking of sobering, we're going to switch gears here a little bit, and let's look at the probable, potential next mayor of New York City. Here he is.
Of the neighborhood.
All right. You are a self-described Democratic socialist. Do you think that billionaires have a right to exist?
I don't think that we should have billionaires, because frankly, it is so much money in a moment of such inequality. And ultimately, what we need more of is equality across our city and across our state and across our country. And I look forward to work with everyone, including billionaires, to make a city that is fairer for all of them.
Well,
one of the most interesting things I've learned about this guy's background is he didn't get radicalized in Uganda. He got radicalized in an American university system that has been infiltrated by communists, domestic and foreign, frankly. And it's frightening that these people now are a breath away from power.
It is. And I think it ties into what we were just talking about. Imagine someone like him getting into the levels of power where he deems wealthy people, people that worked hard, were successful, earned a living, as potential domestic terrorists because they made too much money. And it is frightening what our university system is doing. Just a couple of days ago, Mandani came out and talked about government-run grocery stores. Now, any education system that is worth a dime would teach, when it comes to communism, that they had these government-run grocery stores in the Soviet Union. And it didn't really work out too well for the Soviets. They had to go wheelbarrows of Russian rubles to get a loaf of bread, and store shelves were empty. Yet you look at it, they're elevating him, hoping that he is the next mayor. And if you look at his supporters, because I think that's critical, well, his supporters are the wealthy, educated elite, the ones that went through the same university system that he did and got indoctrinated with this belief of a socialist utopia that Karl Marx states is the very first phase of communism.
Good God. Professor, you're involved in the university system. How involved is China?
Well, at Campus Reform, we put out a report where colleges and universities throughout the entire country are receiving billions upon billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars. And it becomes a national security issue because these countries give that money to buy influence. They don't just give that money because they believe in the American institution system. They give the money to buy influence so that, you know, maybe they'll get better treatment when they're on college campuses. They'll accept more foreign students. That one third of college tuition is now covered by foreign students. The universities have become reliant on this money. And I think it's a very dangerous thing. I mean, look at what happened just a few weeks ago. You have a Chinese student coming in on a student visa, trying to smuggle a bioterror agent into the United States. That should be unacceptable. Now, what gave that person the idea that they should be able to do this? Well, it's because of the influence that China has, but it's not just China. We see Qatar giving tons of money, Saudi Arabia. This has become a real problem, and this is something that Congress should immediately investigate, is how reliant on these universities on foreign funds, and what have they done for these foreign countries?
Yeah, they did something. Professor, as always, thank you. Come back. All right. Lighten the mood. Next. All right. It is time to lighten the mood. And I guess maybe I'm just in a good mood today because I opened up the show talking about wonderful things, things you have done. Let's talk about something else you have done. You see, the month of June is over. It's July 1st. And June has been assaulted and made into this degenerate Pride Month in the United States of America. But I want you to look at something. I want you to look at New York City's pride. I want you to look at this. Do you see that? The drop in corporate sponsorship? I want you to look at that headline. Burn it into your head. Do you know why? And by the way, New York City wasn't alone. They're just the ones we isolated. San Francisco went through the same thing. This happened in Pride Parade after Pride Parade across the United States of America. Burn that into your head because you did that. Donald Trump didn't do that. The GOP House, the GOP Senate, your governor, I don't care. Nobody did that but you. You did that because you finally started putting your money where your morals are. You finally started making corporate America afraid of you. For years and years and years, corporate America was only afraid of one side, the degenerate demons. When they would sit down in a boardroom and think about how many trannies should we sponsor this month, they never had the tiniest bit of fear of you, that you would take your money elsewhere, because we always had this pathetic, well, we don't boycott, that's not who we are, this pathetic attitude. Instead, we realized we have to make these people take us and our values into account, and we started to punish corporate America for their sins, and now they are backing away. Let this be a reminder to you that you cannot live and let live your way out of communism. You can't laissez-faire your way out of it. You have to engage and fight, and if you do, you can win. We can win. You are the one who turned down the volume on Pride Month. Be proud of yourself. I'll see you tomorrow.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.